Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
7 years ago, the tanks rolled and the bombs began to fall in Iraq.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure.
And the deeds that we do in the next few weeks are the deeds that will echo throughout eternity.
7 years may feel like an eternity, but the many echoes from the Iraq invasion make for a confusing history. Plans dashed, some missions not accomplished, other missions creeping into an operation that continues long past the expectations of that reluctant president who ordered it. 7 years into Iraq, we're still looking at a first draft of history. On The Takeaway.
A UN chief.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, March 19th. 7 years in Iraq does seem like an eternity, and we have a few more years to go, it would appear.
You know, my son's only 11. The Iraq war's been going on for most of his life.
That's
an odd thing.
Right.
Let's get a
most
check
of
the
kids' lives, too.
Morning's top news. A high noon showdown coming on Sunday. A final vote is scheduled in the House on health care. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer tells CBS News they may not have the votes yet, but...
We think members are going to conclude by Sunday this is the bill that does what we said we would do, and they're going to pass it.
Incentives are being added to attract more votes, including insurance subsidies and a $250 rebate to help seniors pay for drugs. Earlier, we spoke to Democratic Congressman John Dingell of Michigan. He's the longest-serving representative in the House and the longest-serving advocate for health care reform. He says the bill addresses the problem of rising costs. As things stand...
The average family is going to be paying $25,000 for health insurance in 2019.
But anti-abortion Democrats say this morning they'll oppose the bill unless the language is toughened in restricting federal dollars for abortion.
The Congressional Hispanic Caucus threw its support behind the bill yesterday. The same day, a bipartisan proposal to revamp the nation's immigration system was unveiled. That proposal would require illegal immigrants to admit they broke the law before they could gain legal status and require all U.S. workers to carry a national identity card to prove they are eligible for work. President Obama calls it a good starting point. In Moscow this morning, the so-called Quartet of Middle East Mediators called on Israel to freeze all settlement activities in the West Bank. The quartet, which consists of the U.S., the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, also called on Israel and the Palestinians to return to direct peace negotiations within the next 2 years. We are 7 years into the war in Iraq. We're discussing that all morning here at The Takeaway. We're joined now by Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So you heard that quote from Dick Cheney back in 1994. Cheney got it right on Iraq, then he got it wrong, which is pretty ironic and strange. Did anyone just get Iraq right?
No, because we don't know what the final chapter on Iraq is going to be. And we don't even know how many more there are going to be before we're going to be able to say what the final verdict on the Iraq war was.
And I suspect there are going to be a few more Michael Isikoff bylines before the Iraq war is done. Stay with us. A discussion on Iraq 7 years later with Michael Isikoff in just a moment. Asian and European markets are up. Checking the markets, futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway on Wall Street at 10,779. The S&P opens at 1,165. And the Nasdaq opens at 2,391. Movie Friday, and we're going to talk about the release of The Runaways and have a discussion of girl band movies later this hour.
Coming up, as you said, we're thinking about the Iraq War, and now in its seventh year, and one of the things we're thinking about is that we're now a nation that's accustomed to war in a way that we have not been since the Vietnam War or World War II. What does that feel like in 2010, to be 7 years in and be used to being at war? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. That'd actually be a good essay project, I think, for kids. Because as we say, children have been at war now for their nation.
For their whole lives.
For most of, if not all of their lives.
It's probably easier for them to be accustomed to war than some of us who remember the Vietnam era and then the lack of war.
I grew up in the 80s. Yeah. That was completely foreign
Indeed.
To me. That was the
Indeed.
History books only. Yeah. We're going to talk more about that, what has come to us in the past 7 years of war in Iraq, in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. For 7 years ago today, we began to hear sounds like this. invasion of Iraq was beginning. Of course, the people of Baghdad were hearing those sounds firsthand. The irony today is, even though this war, which dominated the headlines for years after 2003, it's because of a lack of news that today we are permitted really to look back at the seventh anniversary.
That's an interesting
of a war
point.
That now is, in a very real sense, faded from the headlines, but very much a part of the U.S. experience. Here's a George W. Bush speaking to the American people on March 20th, 2003.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Well, what the military and the coalition forces in Iraq discovered quickly is that there was no grave danger, that the disarming of Iraq had already been begun by Saddam Hussein himself, and the freeing of the Iraqi people is still something that political forces in Iraq are grappling with even today. Joining us now is Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine, very much involved in the coverage of the original rationale for the war 7 years ago. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
When you look back 7 years, what was the most important thing on your mind as the tanks went in as to what we would see inside Iraq in those early days, weeks, and months of the war?
Well, look, once the tanks rolled in, I think that everybody in the country was focused on how things were going to go, on achieving victory, on minimizing American casualties. That was clearly the first priority, and I think what was going through people's minds. But, you know, very quickly, once it was clear that the initial military invasion was going to go relatively smoothly, it was where was Saddam Hussein and where were the weapons of mass destruction?
And do you remember the Chinese reporter that kept asking at the briefings, where is the WMD, where is the weapons of mass destruction? It began with her voice and then eventually became all of the reporters, and even the government began asking. Why, first of all, was the intel so wrong?
Well, books have been written on that subject, one by myself and David Gorn. But clearly, there was a desire by the top levels of the Bush administration and senior officials to correct the wrong of the Persian Gulf War, topple Saddam Hussein, and assert American power in the aftermath of 9/11. And in order to sell the war, the intelligence was stretched, massaged, exaggerated, embellished, and in some cases as close to invented as you can go, in order to make an invasion palatable and make sense to the American public. And while there clearly was a consensus that Saddam Hussein had something within the intelligence community, it was made to seem much graver, more imminent, and dangerous to the American national security than any of the intelligence supported. Once people went there, it clearly, the facts didn't warrant it.
Well, certainly the intelligence was massaged, as you say, to create a link between the war on terror and Iraq that really wasn't there. But then almost, you know, within the first couple of years, it became clear that the Iraq operation was one of survival and avoiding a quagmire and avoiding a complete collapse of the country, which meant the mission was even farther removed from the war on terror. 7 years looking back, was this conflict ever about the war on terror at all in a real sense?
Well, in the sense that I think the psychological impulse of for the invasion was 9/11. In other words,
well, that's revenge.
Revenge. The desire to assert American power, to show the world that we were not going to take it, regardless of whether. I mean, we all know, it was pretty much known then, but we certainly have known since, that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and the people that perpetrated 9/11. Although the link, you know, people in the administration did try to make that link, there wasn't any.
And some still try to maintain that. I guess, to turn it the other way around, If you were to look at the rationale, that famous sort of Colin Powell unveiling of intelligence that rationalized the invasion, is the Iraq War 7 years later, could it be seen as a textbook for a nation who might want to actually conceal WMDs? Certainly the intelligence tactics that the U.S. had, the surveillance is all known. The sense that the international community maybe isn't going to buy this a second or a third time around. Has the U.S. unwittingly given a kind of instruction book for a rogue nation to do this?
It's an interesting question. Certainly in the context of the current standoff with Iran and Iran's nuclear program, I think that that's where in my mind the real current day reverberations about from the embellishments and essential propaganda that led up to the Iraq War has had its effect in dealing with Iran, where there's much more skepticism about everything the United States government says, which probably gives the Iranians, as a perfect example, perhaps more leeway than they otherwise might have.
Finally, do you ever believe this would go 7 years?
No, of course not. And we don't know how many more years we've got to go, do we? I mean,
well, we'll talk to you, in another seven.
We still have the troops there. I do think President Obama is committed to getting the troops out. He has to. Just as he has to get health care passed, he has to get American troops out of Iraq.
And we're actually counting the votes in Iraq, which is another positive we've noted this week. Mike Lisigoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine, thinking about the complications and the possible lessons 7 years into the war in Iraq.
About 15 minutes ago, the air raid siren sounded across Baghdad. Anti-aircraft artillery began firing across the night sky. There were a couple of large explosions and I can see a few large plumes of smoke. I presume that may have been targets being hit, but I cannot be certain. It's gone quiet now. First light is breaking. The street is still completely empty.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
Republicans are working hard to stall the health care bill. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says pushing health care may be a problem for Democrats come November.
That kind of arrogance usually precedes a big fall. The American people have followed this issue like no other in the time that I've been here in Congress.
Democrats say they're close to having enough votes to pass the bill in the House, but some party members, like Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan, remain against the bill because of its language on abortion. He spoke to ABC News this morning.
There's still no change. My group is holding firm. We're still no votes.
To Florida now, where Miami's public hospital group says it's got a plan to tackle its severe budget shortfall. The plan would cut more than 600 positions from the nation's third largest public hospital system. But healthcare union president Vivian Dixon Shim says the job cuts would be disastrous for day-to-day operations.
They are the front line of this institution. If a room is not clean and the lights are not fixed, nobody else can work. The operating room cannot work. So, of course, that is a concern.
The rescue plan also calls for delaying some debt payments. And finally, Pope Benedict will sign a letter today he's written to Roman Catholics in Ireland. It sets out new guidelines to try and prevent more cases of the sexual abuse of children by priests. The letter to the Irish faithful will be published on Saturday and read out in churches in Ireland on Sunday.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, a year ago, North Dakota faced an overflowing Red River, and this year they face an overflowing Red River. What's going on and why this constantly recurring flood in Fargo, North Dakota? We'll talk about that in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for a takeout on stories that we're following this week, or maybe I should say stories that we're following this year. Volunteers in North Dakota have filled their 1 millionth sandbag as the Red River in Fargo is expected to crest this weekend at 38 feet. We're joined by Todd McDonald. He's a reporter at Prairie Public Broadcasting. He joins us from Fargo, and he actually rejoins us because, Todd, you were on the show a year ago, almost to the day, on this same story.
The catchphrase is the perfect storm. Late in the season, we saw not only a quick warming, we also saw rain, and another winter blizzard kind of came in and capped off everything and set us on that track for flood preparations.
So, Todd, without sounding flip about a situation which is obviously a crisis, is North Dakota every year hit by the perfect storm?
Not every year, no. Actually, this year we've actually had the ideal melt. It's been almost like a clockwork flood fight here.
Are you in what's considered to be dangerous floodplains there?
We're in what the National Weather Service describes as major flood category. But as far as danger, the meteorologists were hoping for a gentle spring, and it's been delivered to us in spades.
Okay, so what are the conditions in Fargo today?
Last I noticed, the river was at 35 feet, expected to crest at 38 feet sometime Sunday, probably early Sunday morning. And from there, you just wait, you monitor the levees until the water starts receding.
And how high can the river go before it becomes a true crisis?
We are prepared for 40 feet right now.
Okay.
So it gives up about 2 feet of freeboard, and if it starts rising, they will. They do have sandbags at the ready in case they do need to go higher, but it gets very costly for every additional foot you go.
Okay, well, you know, it begs the question as to why you would live in a floodplain in which any kind of particularly warm spring leads to danger of flooding.
Well, why does anybody want to live in the bottom
of
Glacial Lake?
Fargo's
exactly.
A great place.
It's
yeah.
The quality of life.
This isn't about Fargo, John. Don't make this about Fargo.
But, Todd, you're taking no chances there, right?
Oh, no. You never take chances.
But Todd, this leads to this program that the government there is involved in, which is actually to purchase some of these homes that are in the most dangerous locations.
That's been happening for over the years, yes. Ever since 1997, they started buying out homes that had, you know, walkout basements that faced the river and a nice little scenic view, but when the river does come up, you run a pretty significant chance of having some damage.
But you still there's 3 dozen homeowners have taken government money. They've relocated. There are still some who won't move. Why? How come?
Do you enjoy the view?
They enjoy the view. Okay, Todd McDonald.
When you have deer walking through your backyard.
It's a beautiful place. Fargo is a beautiful place. Absolutely.
You bet.
Right now, though, the Red River in Fargo is rising rapidly, and they're hoping it doesn't rise above 40 feet. Todd McDonald's a reporter at Prairie Public Broadcasting.
I love this next take. Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is here in the studio. So Alan Greenspan, all right, is going to deliver a 48-page paper titled The Crisis, and it's his sort of examination of the causes of the financial meltdown. Some people would just shorten that paper to 2 words, Alan Greenspan, right? Does he have any credibility on this subject at this point, Louise?
Well, you know, John, he put out an autobiography in which he really defended his tenure. But there's people think it's kind of a big deal that in this paper he's admitting that he failed to see the housing bubble. Some people would say it's a no-brainer here that, you know, people failed to see the housing bubble. But he's admitting in this paper, he'll present it today at the Brookings Institute, that he failed to see it. What he is not admitting to, which people have accused him of, is he is not saying that his interest rate policy contributed. There's a lot of economists out there who are saying his low interest rates contributed, and he's still arguing that it didn't.
You know, it's interesting. You watched the hearings when Bernanke was in front
yep.
of the House. Ron Paul was asking Bernanke all about, were interest rates left too low too long,
yep.
referring to the Greenspan period. I was surprised that Bernanke basically said, well, we kind of don't know the answer to that.
Well,
the,
and you know,
Bernanke is mixed there.
Bernanke was involved with the Fed when Greenspan mm-hmm. was running it. So Greenspan did give a very interesting alternative argument on the interest rates, which I hadn't seen before. It's in this paper. What he says is that he controlled the short-term interest rates. You know, the Fed controls these overnight interest rates, and that the short-term interest rates are not what contributed. He says it's the low long-term interest rates that contributed, and those were influenced more by countries like China that became much bigger exporters than importers and which were saving so much money and buying U.S. treasuries. And so he's saying it's the long-term interest rates. That's not what I was over. It's not the ones that I controlled, the short-term interest rates.
Can he really make that argument, though? I mean, is it really the case that long-term interest rates are just set by the market and exporters overseas and that short-term interest rates don't send a signal, especially if they're down for as long as they were under Greenspan, that it's time of easy money, and that's going to affect bubbles somewhere?
Well, you know, even some of Greenspan's closest friends, there's an economist at Stanford, John Taylor, who's very close with him, have criticized him and said he's wrong, that it was his interest rates. And I do think, like Bernanke said, that, you know, time will tell and historians will be dwelling this one for a long time.
You know, one of the things that Greenspan writes in this report that he's going to present at the Brookings Institution, as you say, I fear that preventing bubbles will in the end turn out to be infeasible. Assuaging their aftermath seems to be the best we can hope for. Now, if that's actually true, I mean, aside from being fairly self-justifying and self-rationalizing, I mean, that's sort of a disaster because the Obama administration has basically committed itself to creating a regime of regulations that this will never happen again.
Well, he's refuting this. You know, there's this new council that's being created to have a Zeus-like power to look out for systemic risk and catch it. And he says he doesn't think you can find a bubble if it's coming up. What he says you should do is increase the capital and liquidity rules on the banks so that whenever the next bubble occurs, and it will occur, they'll be able to withstand it better, and we won't have such a big financial crisis that really kills the economy like this one did for at least a time.
So, lesson from Greenspan, the bubble is always where we're not looking. That's why you can never see it. Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Coming up.
It's an historic debate. It's a historic vote.
Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, showdown on health care reform set for as early as Sunday. Todd Zwillick joins us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the healthcare vote could happen as early as Sunday. If you're wondering what's in it for me, Todd Zwillick has the answer to that in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. News this morning from the Vatican. The Pope will publish a historic papal letter of apology tomorrow. It will apologize for Roman Catholic priests who've abused children. There have been cases of pedophile priests around the world, including the U.S., Germany, Brazil, and Ireland. One victim, Andrew Madden on CBS News this morning, says the letter is not enough.
I don't think a pastoral letter is the proper context in which to respond to a report about the cover-up of the rape of children.
The first papal letter of apology for sex abuse in the church. In Moscow this morning, a quartet of top international leaders is condemning Israel's decision to build housing in disputed East Jerusalem, calling for a freeze on all construction. The group of leaders, made up of the U.S., the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, also called on Israel and the Palestinians to restart peace talks soon. Here's U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
The quartet believes these negotiations should lead to a settlement negotiated between the parties within 24 months.
But while world leaders are urging peace, here's the sound from the Gaza Strip. Israeli warplanes attacking targets after a rocket strike by Palestinian militants on southern Israel killed one person.
As the healthcare vote approaches, it's not the only overhaul in town. A bipartisan proposal to revamp the nation's immigration system was unveiled yesterday. Illegal immigrants would have to admit they broke the law before they could gain legal status, and there would be national identity cards for all workers. More and more American children are becoming obese at an early age. Studies show more than 7% of boys and 5% of girls are classified as extremely obese. Checking the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are mixed. The Dow starts at 10,779. The S&P opens at 1,165, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,391. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday, Democrats unveiled the full version of the health care bill that they hope to pass as soon as Sunday. We also got the Congressional Budget Office to weigh in as well. And President Obama has postponed for a second time his trip to Indonesia and Australia so he could participate in the final hours of the health care debate in Washington, at least for the House. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi thinks that's a good thing.
I'm delighted that he's going to be here. It's an historic debate. It's a historic vote. And I know he wants to be here.
Did you ask him to do that, ma'am?
No.
Pelosi is actually talking to our man on the Hill there, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Besides chasing down the Speaker of the House yesterday, Todd actually read the health care bill, right, Todd?
Yes, indeed.
You're a better man than I, Todd. I read the boiling down of the health care bill because it's very long. But you discovered as you were reading it five new changes in this version of the bill that maybe could change people's mind about the health care reform push, maybe for it or against it. And it all comes down to money, right?
Yeah, it really does. Five changes, you know, that really affect people's pocketbooks. Now, it's complicated, so I want to just choose a family of four that makes $44,000. If you're a family like that, what this bill does is say that the premiums that you pay on your health care can't be any more than about $2,800 in a year. That's the limit. Now, that's less than what was in the Senate bill. It used to be around $3,000. So they've lowered that. You can't pay more than $2,700. They're also going to give you subsidies if you're this family that makes $44,000 a year, a family of four. The government also gives you subsidies to cover a percentage of your coverage. And those subsidies now will pay for 87% of all your benefits. Before, it was just 80%. So more subsidies to pay for more coverage. Medicare, if you have Medicare, you're 65 or older, or grandma or grandpa have Medicare. You know, right now, Celeste, you know about the Medicare donut hole.
Right.
It only covers part. The gap, which comes around, you know, once you've spent $2,800 on your drug coverage, Medicare doesn't cover you anymore at all until you reach $4,500. Well, if you're one of the people who gets to the gap, they're going to send you a check for $250 right away next year. You just get a check. And then after that, there's drug discounts that phase in starting at a 50% discount. And by 2020, that discount is 75%. That basically closes the Medicare donut hole completely by 2020.
Okay, so we're talking about closing the gap, or at least mostly closing this Medicare donut hole that has bothered people for a very long time. You're also talking about some tax credits and sort of cost-sharing help for people who are in the middle-class bracket. But one thing we've been talking about here a lot is this proposal that was in there that specifically targets student loan programs and helps out college students. Did that end up in the final bill?
That's in there for now. It should stay in there once the Senate acts on reconciliation eventually. They're spending around $70 billion to increase Pell Grants and student loans. The Pell Grants now for people to afford college tuition are around $5,200 a year. This would increase them every single year by inflation plus a little bit to increase the level of those level of that tuition assistance every single year. You get more money to go to college.
Okay, that's a lot of dollar amounts, and they all are on the positive side. But somebody's got to lose out in this bill.
Indeed. If you are a person who makes $200,000 a year or more, or $250,000 for a family, they're raising your taxes. There's a 2.9% tax, a Medicare tax on your earned income. And then additionally, they're putting a 3.8% tax on unearned income. That's capital gains, that's dividends, that's money you make on stocks. If you're a wealthier person, there's a tax increase in here. No doubt about it.
Okay. So obviously there's at this point with President Obama meeting with people who are on the fence, with Democrats slowly trickling into the yes column from the no or the maybe column, what kind of deals are being made behind closed doors that we should be worried about?
Well, they're all over the place, and you can call them deals. You know, people have concerns that they want, you know, there's horse trading, but there is whipping and head counting going on all over the place. And the interests are all over the place. Listen to Barron Hill. He represents a district in southern Indiana that makes medical devices, and he's on the fence. He hasn't decided, and he's not happy about some of the provisions in this bill on medical devices. Listen to this.
Eyeglasses, ear aids, bedpans, those kinds of things got exempted. You know, I'm making the case that since these companies in my district make life-saving devices, that they ought to be given a little help here.
This was very interesting. You spoke with Luis Gutierrez, who's changed his vote to yes. And I was really interested to find out why he did that.
Right. Luis Gutierrez voted yes the first time, but then he said he might not be yes this time because he didn't like the way this bill treated comprehensive immigration reform. You know how you said in headlines a couple of seconds ago that the White House is now pushing immigration reform?
Right.
It's no coincidence. Listen to Luis Gutierrez.
Maybe the first time I've actually had a conversation with the president alone was today at the rope line when we went for the swearing in, and he got to reaffirm that he was going to work hard on immigration reform.
So that sounds like he's putting his vote firmly in the yes column because of this commitment to work on immigration.
And he said exactly that. He wanted a commitment for comprehensive reform. And how about that announcement from the White House the day Luis Gutierrez said he would vote yes? You think that's a coincidence? I don't think so.
I do not. So Todd Zwillick, in the last question for you, if you're going to grade this as a piece of effective legislation based on your experience, what grade would you give it?
Effective? Well, they say it's going to lower the deficit by $1.2 trillion in the next 20 years. That's a good thing. There's a big debate about whether this will lower health care spending, the actual amount we spend on health services.
A, B, C, D?
Pass.
He will not say. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. But Todd will say what's happening on the Hill all weekend long. Political junkies can follow Todd on Twitter. He's going to be tweeting about the head counting, the vote whipping today all through the weekend. You can follow his feed on our site, thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, Todd.
So as of yesterday, first round NCAA tournament reality hit all the dreamy brackets out there that people have in their office pools. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joins us, Takeaway Sports contributor. We'll talk about your bracket in a moment, but first of all, man, you really called it on that BYU-Florida game. Let's just listen to what you said yesterday.
BYU versus Florida, that's where you'll get Jimmer Fredette. He's averaged 21.7 points a game. So if you want to see a really good score, Jimmer Fredette, BYU, Florida.
And Jimmer Fredette delivered. Did you see that game?
I saw parts of it. I saw the end, obviously.
37 points.
Yeah, he dropped it. He made it happen.
He was unbelievable. How'd you call that?
Well, I mean, when you get a guy who can score a lot, who comes from a team that you haven't focused on, this is his opportunity to be on the national stage. He's proven that he can drop points on people all season long. This is his moment, and he took advantage of it.
Does he have a chance to go pro?
Well, I think, you know, he's kind of like
an
Adam Morrison style.
Yeah.
Where you're going to be able to drop points and maybe you can make transition to pros, maybe not.
That's what I love. I mean, it's all about the Hail Mary. Look at me, look at me, 37 points. All right, what happened to your bracket?
Well, my bracket did great. I would say that me and President Obama's brackets were similar. Me and President Obama's brackets had some similar things. The Murray State stuff hurt, but I'll tell you this. And this is going to be in the headlines throughout the country about the Big East. The Big East is the Big Least. And you'll see that on headlines all over the place because my brackets, I like the Big East because they were a power conference. They had 8 teams in the tournament. But Marquette went down, Georgetown went down, and Notre Dame went down. And those are 3 teams that I thought would do pretty well.
Now let's recap. Old Dominion, the number 11 seed, beats Notre Dame, a number 6. Number 14, Ohio, beat number 3, Georgetown, as you mentioned. And Murray State, number 13 seed, beats number 4.
And that was another one of President Obama's picks. And we'll get a couple of those Obama picks for this weekend as well.
Let's listen to that classic NCAA tournament upset sound.
And Old Dominion has defeated Notre Dame 51-50. Oh, my. And 13-seeded Murray State has pulled off the opening round shocker.
You know, St. Mary's came within a whisker of beating Villanova, too. These early rounds are so exciting.
And that Villanova game, that was a prime example of the Villanova coach getting out-coached. Even though their team and the talent gap was so clear, but the Villanova team was out-coached, and that's going to hurt them going into the further rounds. If they don't address some of those late-game coaching stuff, then Villanova's in danger.
Well, I had to go to bed early last night, but I woke up this morning and I heard the story. Who's the guy who shot at the buzzer and won the game? Ismail Smith. There was a Hail Mary play, shot at the buzzer.
I think what you're seeing now, this is the thing. The three-point shot is the dagger in the NCAA tournament. So the first round, that's what you're going to get. So you get a team like Lehigh who was fighting with Kansas last night, but the reason why they couldn't go over the hump is they didn't have the three-point shot. But like with Marquette and with Washington, the reason why Washington was able to beat them is because they were playing three ball the entire game.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what you look for in the first round also. And and that's what you saw yesterday.
Yeah, it was at Wake Forest at the buzzer, Ismail Smith, right?
And that was exactly. And I think that was one of those.
I'm half asleep.
One of those games where the top seeds did very well yesterday, but the seeds that were closest, it was razor thin was the margin.
Well, we'll have a lot to talk about on Monday. Watch the tournament all weekend long.
It'll get all the way to the regionals, so it'll be exciting.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm joined here by John Hockenberry. And, of course, we were talking about movies here at Good Do every single Friday. And a new movie, The Runaways, is coming out in limited release this weekend. And it got us thinking about girl band movies. So the trivia question we have for you today.
Is that a genre, girl band movie?
It is a true genre.
All right.
Okay, so both Diane Lane and Julia Roberts made early appearances in girl band flicks. Actually, Julia Roberts made her debut in a girl band flick. Tell us what those movies were.
Two separate movies.
Post your response on our Facebook, or you can email us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org, and we're going to talk more about that in a few moments. But first, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. A business story from abroad that could have implications for American businesses operating in China. Rio Tinto, one of the world's largest mining firms, is doing a deal with China to mine one of the largest iron ore deposits in the world. Okay, that's one side of the story. The other is four executives from Rio Tinto are facing trial in China on charges of commercial espionage. BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett joined us earlier this morning, and he told us what the charges are that the executives are facing.
Well, the allegation is that the members of staff at Rio Tinto were involved in taking bribes and industrial espionage. This goes back to discussions that China was having over the price of iron ore last year when these men were arrested, and their trial is due to take place next week. What's really striking here, though, is that China has teamed up with Rio Tinto, despite the diplomatic fallout of that trial, and has said that it will form a joint venture with it to look for iron ore in Guinea, which is in West Africa. Actually, Guinea is one of the most rich countries in Africa in terms of natural resources, although most of the people there live in absolute poverty. The deal is worth a lot of money. China's talking about putting about $1.3 billion into it. And Rio Tinto, which is an Anglo-Australian company, is talking about a similar sum. So it has the power to really transform that country completely.
Could these espionage charges against the Rio Tinto executives be a warning to other businesses who may be thinking of operating in China?
Well, I think that there was that fear when the people were arrested last year that perhaps China was not entirely reliable in terms of its foreign partnerships. There was quite a lot of concern, particularly on Australia, on this issue as to whether it would affect trade relations. However, the imperative for China at the moment is to try to find more natural resources to fund its economic expansion, in particular its steel industry. And it's estimated that last year China spent something like $30 billion around the world buying up assets, particularly oil and iron ore and so on, in Africa and in other parts of the world. That hasn't stopped yet, and even a little bit of diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing with one of its partner countries, Australia, doesn't seem to have affected that overall aim by China, which is to make sure that it has access to the natural resources which will keep its industry growing and its economy growing for many years to come.
That was Duncan Bartlett, business correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
In other headlines, March Madness basketball is all weekend long, and so is the health care reform debate. President Obama and other top Democrats continue a full-court press on health care reform. Meanwhile, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus announced they would support the health care reform bill after a bipartisan proposal was unveiled to revamp the nation's immigration system. And we learned from our partner, the BBC, that a man and a woman from two tribes, which until the 1960s have been completely isolated from the world deep inside of Brazil, married after meeting in an internet chat room. It's a sign that even small indigenous communities around the world are being affected by a social network. Can you believe that? Two tribes completely isolated from the world. Married,
that's an amazing
intermarrying
story.
Because of an internet chat room. Who gave them the chat room? That's what I want to know. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Get down, ladies, you got nothing to lose. Hello, Daddy. Hello, Mom. Cherry Bob.
It's Friday, and that means on The Takeaway that we're talking about movies. The music you're hearing is the 1970s girl power band The Runaways singing Cherry Bomb. You recognize that, John?
Oh, sure.
Starting today, they're actually going to be immortalized in a film which is widely anticipated. It hits theaters in limited release, and it follows the real-life story of Joan Jett and Cherie Currie's rise to fame.
They're already immortal, though. I mean,
they are.
They're immortal.
They are, yeah. But these movies can sometimes help establish those memories or sometimes tear them down. We're joined by Emily Rams, who's the managing editor for Bust Magazine. Girl, grown man movies, she says, are a definite genre. And Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and Newsday writer, who's also here with his take on girl band movies, the best. But Emily, you've seen this movie. What did you think?
I thought it rocked.
Really?
I wanted to, jump out of my chair and fist pump.
Okay, and Rafer, let's get your quick take. Runaways, yes or no?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I think it's got a lot of really good energy. It's really rare to see, I think, in a movie like this, in a teen movie even, and it feels really authentic. It's got a lot of great period detail, the platform shoes and the short shorts and the teardrop sunglasses, and I thought it was really great. Got a heck of an opening scene, too.
Oh, okay, yeah. Emily, I'm going to ask you, let's play the clip from a movie that both you and Rafer listed as one of the best girl band movies ever made.
Corinne Burns, what are you going to do?
My name is not Corinne Burns.
Oh, what is it?
It's a third degree burn. I'm the lead singer and manager for The Staines.
This is from the movie Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Staines of 1981. And I got to ask you, you guys both list this as a great girl band movie. What are the qualifications for a good girl band movie, Emily?
I really think that great girl band movies are inspirational to girls. Like, they always seem to have, like, the trappings of, like, very sexy, usually young girls that draw the dudes in. But really, at the core of the good ones, it's still very transgressive for girls to rock out and to see girls really doing it. And to have the audience of girls leave the theater or the viewing experience feeling, oh, I see that, I want to do that.
You got
to
get into the transformation of the character, that's for sure. I mean, the thing about The Runaways is it's like you're reliving Joan Jett, but with The Staines, I mean, you're down in the growth of these girls. They're coming of age, and I thought that was really a great insight.
Yeah.
So let's talk, Rafer, about another movie that you loved, which is Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
And let's hear a clip of that.
Here, have some grass. Aunt Susan won't see you.
Oh, no thanks, man. In a scene like this, you get a contact high.
So, Rafer, what, in your opinion, makes a good girl band movie, and why is this one of them?
I think I would agree with Emily. I think the real point is to not let is to make sure that the girls are really doing it for and by themselves, and that they're being inspirational and not being used necessarily. I mean, unfortunately, that's never quite the case.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not the case in The Runaways, really. It's certainly not the case in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, where the band is the Carrie
right.
Nations.
Yeah.
But,
and you couldn't do a girl band movie about En Vogue, right?
Don't forget the
Spice World movie about the Spice Girls.
Right. But again, I think pop, which is now a female-dominated genre, is very, very different from rock, which has always been a male-dominated genre. There's plenty of girl pop bands, still very, very few girl rock bands. I mean, the Bangles, the Go-Go's, the Donnas, Slater,
and
Kinney,
interestingly,
Nowhere.
Mickey Steele was
the
somebody who went from The Runaways and then moved on to the Bangles.
Bangles.
Emily, you seem to agree with that maybe the dividing line is that it needs to kind of move out of the pop genre and into rock.
I think the thing about girl band movies that transfers over into the stigma about rock and roll is that there's still that sex, drugs, and rock and roll cachet around it, and it's not always cool for women to put that energy out there.
It's unladylike.
It's unladylike. It's not always glamorous either. It can be dirty. And I think that the girls who are willing to go out there and who the media and the music industry is willing to let go there are still not as many.
Okay, well, we do have this trivia question for you.
I'm stumped on this one, man.
Are you?
Totally.
Okay, so the trivia question. Julia Roberts actually made her debut in a girl band film, and 16-year-old Diane Lane starred in the movie about a punk band. There's a little hint for you there. Name the films. Emily?
Diane Lane was in Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Staines.
Absolutely. And Rafer, you got an answer to the Julia Roberts one?
I think that's Satisfaction.
And I believe that is Justine Bateman singing Satisfaction in the opening credits of the movie. Thanks to Emily Rams, managing editor for Bus Magazine. She says, go see The Runaways. Rafer Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. He also says, go see The Runaways. If you want more movies every week, Rafer and our movie producer, Kristen Meinzer, choose one genre to dig into for our new film podcast. It's called The Takeaways Movie Date. And this week, inspired by The Runaways, Rafer and Kristen talk about their favorite rock movies. So you can check it out at thetakeaway.org.
A sober post to our website now on the conversation of the war in Iraq being 7 years old. Are we accustomed to war in the United States? Jonathan in Detroit posts, of course we're at war. We all stand united under the flag of war. Besides baseball, it's practically America's favorite pastime. Doesn't it make you feel all warm and fuzzy inside? thinking about Iraq 7 years later. Your take at 877-8MY-TAKE or post at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.